morning. The court has four cases set for argument this morning. The first case is entitled Kelly Redland versus First Interstate Bank et al. Attorneys arguing this morning, Corey Devlin is arguing on behalf of the appellant, Kelly Redland, and Vince Roche, and along with Joe Erickson, will be dividing their time up on behalf of Appalese First Interstate Bank and Charles Redland. Mr. Roche, I understand you're going to have 7 minutes, and Mr. Erickson will have 8 minutes. Okay, and then Mr. Donovan, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal after they complete their time. You can proceed.
May it please the court. I'll start my argument today by talking about policy, which is the focus of the bank's brief in this matter, and presumably going to be most of their time spent in oral argument today. A trust, by its very nature, and as defined at 55.1.3, is not a legal entity or a legal person, but a relationship to property between a trustee and trust beneficiaries. The fundamental aim of trust laws is to provide guardrails to ensure that trustees act as proper stewards of the trust corpus. In South Dakota, sometimes we lose sight of that in our laws. In our grasp to obtain more trust companies and more trust business, there's an attempt by trust companies to continuously strip down fiduciary liability standards by legislative enactments. Any attempt by beneficiaries to hold trustees liable for their actions or inactions is met with a bold pronouncement that such holding will end the South Dakota trust industry. I assure you, today, by reversing the trial court's decision in this case, you will not bring about the end of the trust industry in South Dakota. You will, in fact, be strengthening the industry by upholding the proper standard by which to measure the investment actions of a trustee when the prudent investment standard has been waived in the trust instrument. The facts of this case are pretty straightforward. Helene Redland passed away in January 2020. In February 2020, New York Life paid $3 million in cash as a death benefit on Helene's life to the 2004 trust, which Helene had established, and then the $3 million sat uninvested in a money market account until May of 2021. During that 14-month period, the trust only earned $843.23 in interest. Now, the decision by the trial court is not straightforward. The trial court said that the co-trustees are not liable for the damages for failing to properly invest the trust, but cited no standard by which to measure that investment conduct of the co-trustees. It was as if the duty to invest did not exist. And as we cited extensively in our briefing today, that cannot be the case. The trust would be illusory, as you have eliminated part of the nature of the relationship in property between the trustee and the trust beneficiaries. In 2000, the 2004 trust language does not, in fact, eliminate the trustee's duty to invest. Article 11K, that's discussed in the briefing of the 2004 trust, waives the prudent investment rule and grants the trustee the broadest possible discretion in determining proper investments, acceptable level of risk, and investment strategy consistent with its fiduciary duty, meaning the fiduciary duty to invest still exists. They still have that duty. Article 11K simply changed the standard by which the co-trustees' investment conduct would be measured. Ordinarily, under the prudent investment standard, codified at 55.57, provides that the trustee's decision and actions shall be judged in the terms of a trustee's reasonable judgment, a reasonable, prudent person's judgment, an objective standard. So by waiving that provision, then the default rule becomes, under SDCL 55.330, a gross negligence standard. 55.330 says that a provision of a trust instrument relieving a trustee of liability for breach of trust is unenforceable to the extent that it relieves the trust of liability for that breach of trust committed in bad faith or as a result of gross negligence.
Counsel, how do we have a gross negligence or bad faith? How is it present here?
So in this case, if you look at the trustee's conduct, in the investments. We had a trust that was set up to be a trust of last resort for the beneficiaries, meaning that the trustee was only supposed to make a distribution of income and principal when it was necessary for the beneficiary's health care and maintenance. And the trustee was supposed to take into consideration that beneficiary's, all the beneficiary's other assets, even their other trusts of which they were benefactors of. So we had a very long time horizon before the beneficiaries were going to need a distribution because they had other trusts available to them and other assets they have. So in that case, when you have a long horizon before a beneficiary needs a distribution, and given the fact that we were in a low interest rate economic environment, and the fact that the stock market during this 14-month period of time was going gangbusters, it was grossly negligent to simply place that money, $3 million, into a money market account and leave it unattended. That money should have been put into an aggressive portfolio of stocks, bonds, those types of things.
Why would it even have to be aggressive?
What's that?
Why would it have to be aggressive?
It doesn't necessarily have to be aggressive. Our expert witness, Paul Friedel, simply said that because of the long time horizon of investments, a trustee could be more aggressive in its investment strategy rather than being conservative because the principal and the income wouldn't be necessary for a long period.
Is it possible that the waiver of the prudent investor rule was designed to accomplish exactly the opposite of what happened here, which is to say what you just said? It authorized investment in securities or otherwise that might be deemed imprudent or unsuitable in other circumstances. And it authorized, by waiving it, it authorized more aggressive, riskier investments, the opposite of what happened here.
And I think that's right. I think that, but then you take into the facts and circumstances of the case. What is the purpose of the trust? What are the beneficiary's needs? You have to take into consideration all of the factors related to the trust. For example, let's say a trustee receives founder stock in a company that the grantor started, and that's the majority of their assets that is put into that trust. Well, of course, waiving the prudent investor in that case might seem appropriate because under that situation, the trustee and the purpose of the trust is to hold that grantor's primary asset, which is the founder's stock in a particular company. But in this case, we don't have those facts. In this case, we have a situation where he had $3 million in cash and by its very nature should have been invested, not just sitting in a money market account. And that conduct is what you apply the gross negligence standard to.
Wouldn't we usually look for something much more egregious, like embezzlement? I mean, to rise to the level of gross negligence or bad faith, wouldn't we usually look for more egregious conduct, such as investment in an illegal enterprise or an embezzlement or something of that nature?
Well, embezzlement would...
Investment strategy.
Yes. And that's that's what we're talking about. That's the area. Embezzlement, something different, a different type of breach, not a failure to properly invest the money. In this case, you would look at gross negligence. And I want to point the court's attention to In Re, it's the Scheidmantel case. And I apologize for not citing it in our brief, but it's In Re Scheidmantel, 868 A2nd 464, Pennsylvania, 2005. And in the Scheidmantel case, it's a good case because it talks about what does gross negligence look like when you're gauging the investments of a trustee. It goes through a long discussion of that. And in there, they say that even when a trustee who must act with gross negligence must be able to demonstrate that the chosen investment strategy was not based on a conscious act taken in reckless disregard of the consequences to the trust or omission occurring in reckless disregard of the consequences to the trust. So in other words, it could be grossly negligent if you simply never attended to the assets in the trust, never made any decision of how to invest those assets, never reevaluated the investments.
Well, that's a Pennsylvania standard. We've talked about gross negligence in other statutory settings, you know, such as work comp and parks, things like that, where there's a gross negligence standard, and it's a pretty high standard. We've said gross negligence is, for all practical purposes, is substantially synonymous with the phrase willful wanton misconduct. Holding that gross negligence is really a misnomer in the conduct described by those words. How do you get over that kind of a hurdle in this case where they make a decision, you know, maybe they decide, you know, this is, you know, the years you're talking about, this is during COVID. They may have decided, you know what, it's too risky to invest in the market right now. That's just negligence, isn't it?
Well, one of the phrases that you left out in that description of gross negligence is reckless conduct. And so you could have, you know, the words that we use to describe what gross negligence is less important in how you evaluate the conduct. And in this case, on this record, we have no evidence as to what happened with the trustees. In the discovery that was had before the summary judgment was filed, there was no documents in the discovery that showed what the trustees were doing, what they thought about, what they considered when they were investing. There was no evidence about why they kept it in the money market account.
That alone, though, could be fatal to the summary judgment, your summary judgment argument. By itself, in the absence of a reason, because you have a duty as a non-moving party, right, when you're considering your opponent's motion for summary judgment. So, and then that, of course, kind of brings up your Rule 56F. But I don't know, as I look at your brief, do we have a Rule 56F issue in front of us? In other words, is the discretion of the court being challenged under the 56F motion that you had made?
Yes, absolutely it is. I mean, the fact of the matter is we have no evidence of the conduct.
But there are standards. If you challenge Rule 56, the denial of Rule 56F, you have to sort of say, we have rules on this, and that you have to say, this is what we would have found. This is what we would have done. This is what we were looking for. We think it's there. This is how we would have got it. It's rather exacting.
Right, and that's what we were looking for. What we would have tried to determine is what are the conduct, what is the decision-making process that went on with the co-trustees when the money came in, and why did they keep it there? And they didn't file in any affidavits telling us why they made the decision that they made, or if they made a decision at all. It might have been as little as a wiring instruction to put the money in a particular account that happened to be a money market.
My point is, though, if you want Rule 56F relief, that's your obligation to demonstrate why you're entitled to Rule 56F relief.
And we filed an affidavit. We filed in our motion 456 asking for, here's what we believe we'll find. Or the absence of evidence is really what we're looking for, is an omission, a decision that was never made, situation where they never made a careful decision about how they were going to invest this money.
Well, that wouldn't change the state of the record at all.
Right now, we have no evidence of what decisions they made. And that, in and of itself, that omission could be gross negligence when you're talking about the conduct of the trustees that are supposed to be fiduciaries administering this particular trust.
Counsel, we also have a provision in the law that says a trustee is not liable for reasonable and good faith reliance on the express provisions of the trust. And many of the arguments you are making here today about what a reasonable investor should have done, and in your view, what would amount to gross negligence if it was not done, seem to be contrary to the express provisions of this particular trust and the broad authority that it allowed trustees to have to the extent of even keeping the trust funds in something that was non-productive. So how do you address that?
Well, to say that you can have an empty head and a full heart as a trustee when it comes to reading a provision of a trust to determine what your duty is in order to invest is not a standard that South Dakota should adopt by any stretch of the imagination. If we rely on 55.512 or 55.512, I think is what you're referring to, as the standard, it's not a standard by its own language as to what how to gauge the trustee's conduct. But they would be incongruent with the loads of case law and secondary sources that we talk about that if that were the process where a trustee could just not come to some subjective understanding of what they think that their duties are under the trust, then we would not have any fiduciary. We would go below the floor of gross negligence that's required when evaluating a trustee's conduct under 55.530.
But why isn't the standard the provisions in the trust?
Well, to the extent, because the trust can only go so far. You can only remove a standard so far. You can only strip it down so far. We have 55.530, that sets that standard that a trustee must be, they cannot go below a gross negligence or willful misconduct standard.
Well, I understand that, but it just seems like applying that standard, you still have to do it in the context of what are the provisions of this particular trust.
Right. And evaluating the trust does not get rid of the duty to invest. I think we all agree to that. I mean, it can't get rid of the fiduciary duty to invest, or we have an illusory trust because we're stripping away the actual duties a trustee owes to the beneficiary, that relationship in property between the trustee and the beneficiaries.
Your time's up, Mr. Denham. Thank you. Mr. Erickson, you're going to go first?
Yes.
Okay.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm here representing Charles Redland as a trustee of the Helene Redland Trust. And I'm going to piggyback on the ending conversation you just had with Mr. Denovan. This appeal comes down to one question. Do the words used by Helene Redland in her trust matter? If they do, this court should affirm the trial court and dismiss Kelly Redland's improper investment claims. The trial court correctly granted summary judgment to Kelly on these improper investment claims because the undisputed material facts establish the following. The trust assets were conservatively invested, and the trust terms expressly allowed the trust assets to be invested conservatively. When we look at SDCL 55-5-7, which is the prudent investor statute, which allows the prudent investors to be waived, that statute goes further. If you look at the third sentence, it discusses the trustees' investment decisions and actions shall be judged in terms of the trustee's reasonable judgment. But the clause prior to that statement says unless expanded, restricted, eliminated, or otherwise altered by the terms of the trust instrument. So prudent investor rule is out. We go to the terms within the trust. Within the trust, there's a description, Article 11, Section K. First, it waives the prudent investor rule. And then it also describes the type of investments that the trustee can make. One of those is non-productive investments. SDCL 55-5-7 controls this analysis. This is the standard by which the trial court granted summary judgment.
So is your argument, Mr. Erickson, that 55-4-30 standard doesn't apply for the terms of the trust?
That is my argument, Your Honor. If we look at the two statutes, we have one specific statute directly on point with trustee investment decisions, which is SDCL 55-5-7. And then you have SDCL 55-4-30, which is where Kelly Redland wants to go to try to prolong this litigation. That statute is a generic statute. It's just talking about provisions within a trust instrument that relieve for a breach of trust. This isn't a scenario where we even have a breach of trust. The trustee is following the exact terms of the trust. And that's where Judge Means went in her memorandum opinion. It's well-reasoned.
Does the trustee have a duty to invest at all? Has the duty been eliminated to the point that it doesn't exist?
The trustee has the duty to invest as described by the terms of the trust. And if which is that he can invest in non-productive fashion or a conservative fashion.
Is it investing at all to park $3 million in cash in a money market account, which may as well be a savings account?
Yes, I believe it is investing. There was interest made. If you took the cash out and put it under your mattress, that's not investing. But that's not what happened. There's a little bit of interest made, and it's in a safe place. The principal stayed intact. That's another type of investment. If we look at the long history of case law with a generic statute versus a specific statute, the specific statute has precedent. And SDCL 55-5-7 describes exactly what was supposed to happen in this case and what did happen.
Counsel, I'd like to turn your attention to whether First Interstate is a co-trustee. In the 2016 instrument, the appointment instrument, there's no language explicitly revoking First National's general trustee status, and there's also a reference to co-trustees. How does that instrument, read in context, remove First National as a general trustee?
Your Honor, that's a really good question, and Mr. Roach is going to be addressing that issue with the bank.
Very good.
I'm not going to...
I'll wait for him. Thank you.
I bet he wrote it down, too. The next part of this, even if SDCL 55-4-30 were to apply, and we had this gross negligence standard, which is different than the terms within the trust document, what's alleged by Kelly Redland is not gross negligence. And this went to the questions asked by the justices. What is alleged is there just wasn't enough money made. There's no allegation of fraud. There's no allegation of self-dealing. There's no allegation that rises to gross negligence or bad faith. If you look at their complaint, they sprinkle this magic language, well, gross negligence, willful wanton behavior. But they don't actually allege anything that supports that, except for that the investment wasn't made the way they wanted it to be made. The problem with that is, again, it's a broken record, but if you go to the terms of the trustee followed what the terms of the trust said they could do with investment decisions.
So is that how you read Article 11, Section O as well?
I don't have that article.
Helene intended to grant the trustee the broadest possible discretion in determining what constitutes an appropriate investment.
Yes, Your Honor, that would be this. I'd read that in the same fashion. And what Article 11, Section K does is actually use specifics. I mean, it actually uses the word non-productive investments. So using specifics gives even more guidance to this court because we know exactly what the trustor was allowing the trustee to do with investments.
Is it possible that the waiver of the prudent investor rule contained in 11K really was meant to authorize more aggressive, not less aggressive, more aggressive investment that otherwise would not have been suited for trust investment, more whatever, things that are illiquid, things that are riskier? Things that become disproportionately balanced relative to the rest of the portfolio. That's also in K.
Correct.
It's exactly the opposite of what happened. So this was the least, if it was an investment at all, it was the least riskiest. Is it possible that waiving it meant to further enable the trustee to do much, much more?
I looked at Section K as... it can do both. It can allow a trustee to be very aggressive, which, as you point out, it does allow that. It has a language irrespective of risk. So the trustee could have had some wild investments. And it also allowed the trustee to invest conservatively through the use of non-productiveness. By including both of those terms, it gave the trustee the discretion to go either way. So I agree that it could have gone the other way, but that's what the trust door allowed the trustee to do, and that's why the trust door made that decision to appoint certain trustees. I would go one step further. The trust terms by the trustor can direct investments in any way they want. The trustor could have had a trust that said, I want you to bet $50,000 a year on the Vikings to win the Super Bowl. Bad investment, but it's what the trustor wants. That's the fundamental aim of South Dakota law. It's not...
Your time's up, Mr. Harris.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Roach, you can proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. Vince Roach on behalf of First Interstate Bank. In the time that I've been allotted, I'm going to focus on the issue at which the bank prevailed at the circuit court, which is the conclusion that as administrative trustee, the bank did not have investment responsibilities. I'm surprised that Mr. Denovan didn't talk about that dispositive issue at all in his remarks, but we're of course focused here on the one-page appointment that Helene Redlin executed on December 5th, 2016, where she appointed her son Charles as trustee and the bank as, quote, administrative trustee to exercise such powers and authorities as the co-trustees may from time to time direct. It's certainly devoid of bells and whistles and simply says what it means. The bank's the administrative trustee only, and Charles is the full trustee with investment responsibility.
So changing the bank to an administrative trustee, why doesn't that operate as some sort of removal as a general trustee?
It does operate as a removal as general trustee.
Okay, and so then the trust has specific provisions required for the removal of a trustee, but those weren't followed in this case.
Well, they were, because the Article 11B specifically allowed Helene to either, and these are words from the trust instrument, amend or revoke a plan of trustees. So in the case of the former trustee, Mr. Ronayne, when he was completely removed, yes, his powers were revoked. But when the bank's powers were amended, as Helene was authorized to do, she did it via way of the appointment, and she didn't need to revoke all of the bank's powers because she was simply changing the scope of the bank's powers.
But there are also specific provisions about how you remove a trustee, correct?
There are, but the bank was never removed as trustee. The plan of trustees was simply amended from the bank being the sole full trustee to the bank being solely the administrative trustee.
But I thought that was the premise of my first question, though, is they weren't removed as you would just, I thought you acknowledged that by amending their status into an administrative trustee from the general trustee, that they were removed as general trustee.
That's true. But then again, I'd go back to the language of either amend or revoke. If you're removing someone in their entirety, then yes, you revoke all of their powers. If you're changing their powers, then it makes sense to amend their powers. And in the course of amending the powers, you say, okay, you're no longer full trustee, now you're administrative trustee only.
Does that category of trustee status exist?
It does, Your Honor. And we cited one of the seminal law review articles from the South Dakota, published in the South Dakota Law Review by Al King and Pierce McDowell several years ago on this issue. And it discusses a directed trustee and refers to it as an administrative trustee, which is exactly the language that's used by Helene in the appointment. And if you look at our statutes, and the key statute is SDCL 55-1B-1 sub 5. It doesn't require any magic words. It doesn't say you have to call the administrative trustee an administrative trustee, you have to call him a directed trustee. No magic words requires. All that the statute requires is a trustee who's been assigned limited duties with the remainder of the duties assigned to someone else. If you have that, you have an excluded fiduciary and a directed trust, and that's what this particular trust instrument permits in Article 3A.
Does the record show, Mr. Roach, whether the fee arrangement changed at all for First Interstate Bank after the supposed change?
The fee arrangement is not in the record, Your Honor. What is in the record that Kelly Redland's counsel put in is that the bank certainly internally referred to itself as an administrative trustee, and so that's what the bank thought, but there is no, in the trial court record, nothing about whether the fee changed or anything like that. But in the law review article that we cited in our brief, that's certainly the concept, is that an administrative trustee naturally charges less for their duties than a trustee with full investment responsibility, because if you're potentially subject to liability for full responsibility, you're going to quadruple your fees.
Right, and that's why I'm asking the question, because I think that'd be kind of an important thing to put in if, in fact, there was a substantive change.
It would have if we had needed to get to the point of extrinsic evidence, but we don't need to here, and the trial court appropriately, in our view, didn't get to any extrinsic evidence because the trial court simply looked at the trust instrument, looked at the appointment, and said, it's very obvious here what Mrs. Redland intended to do when she appointed the bank as administrative trustee. And this court has said repeatedly that the analytical North Star in these trust cases is honoring the settlor's intent. Respectfully, you'd have to do substantial logistical gymnastics to write an opinion concluding that Helene meant anything other than what she wrote in the appointment. She wanted her son to be the full trustee and the bank to be the administrative trustee with limited powers, all as expressly authorized in the trust instrument that she executed in 2004. In my remaining time, I would like to say I think it's also important that the court look at the quality of the authorities that Kelly's presented to you. Her brief cite authorities from other countries, cases from other states that are more than a century old, and irrelevant and uninformed articles that are slinging mud at the trust industry. But none of that controls here. Our legislature has been very precise in establishing our directed trustee statutes over the last several decades, and that's what controls here. In fact, that's why we have a thriving trust industry in our state. If our trust code was the same as the trust code in Oklahoma, for example, you'd have far less reason for an Oklahoma resident to want to come here and establish a South Dakota trust. And this court in particular has been very vigilant about looking at what our legislature has said and what our statutes say, not what a restatement says that might be contrary to the governing law in South Dakota. A recent example of that would be the court's opinion in the Cleopatra case from just a few years ago, where coincidentally Mr. Denovan appropriately convinced the court that the restatement didn't apply where it conflicted with our statutes. So I see my time's drawing short here, and so with my remaining seconds, I'd respectfully ask the court to affirm the trial court on either the basis that the bank had no investment responsibilities as administrative trustee, or on the alternative basis that the bank, that the trust instrument permitted the investments as they were made in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Roach. Mr. Denovan, you can proceed with the rebuttal argument.
Let me start with where we ended the discussion we had. The trust language itself, I think we all agree that there is a fiduciary duty to invest the trust's assets, and it gives wide breadth to the trustee to make those decisions. But it doesn't get rid of a standard that needs to be applied. And yes, we did cite 55.330 that talks about the floor being gross negligence or willful misconduct. But the trust at Article 11X in pertinent part reads, a non-corporate trustee shall not be liable for any loss occasioned by acts in good faith. A non-corporate trustee shall be liable only for willful wrongdoing or gross negligence. Right there in the trust instrument, it sets a standard for conduct of how you evaluate what the trustee is doing. You must apply that when considering what the trustee did or what the trustee did not do. Now, in the record, we don't have any evidence of what the trustee did or did not do, whether it was an act of gross negligence, whether it was an omission that it rises to the level of gross negligence. But you have to evaluate that conduct. Justice Salter, you brought up the idea of, well, there are standards to a Rule 56F motion. Well, at the record, at page 352, paragraph 8 through 10, is Pamela Ryder's affidavit, in which she goes through carefully and it lays out for the court what things she expected to obtain.
And I saw that. I just didn't know if it was raised in this appeal or not.
That the court erred in not allowing...
As a discrete issue.
Yes, yes, we did raise that as an issue in our briefing.
Okay, thank you.
Moving on to... There's a lot of room to cover here. Directed trust. The bank tries to convince you that they're a directed trustee entitled to exoneration from liability for investment conduct as an excluded fiduciary under 55(1)(b)(2). It's certainly true that the 2004 trust provided for the appointment of an investment advisor that could direct the trustee as to investments of the trust. However, it's undisputed that no one was appointed as an investment advisor in this situation. The bank doesn't challenge that. Mr. Redlin doesn't challenge that. They were not going to be directed as to investments. The bank is not a directed trustee with respect to investments. It's not entitled to exoneration from investment liability as an excluded fiduciary under 55(1)(b)(2). Period. Full stop. It's not a directed trust. Second, the bank talks about the co-trustees. And the bank is trying to tell you that it's not a co-trustee. It's undisputed that Helene, in her documents, in her prior documents, removing Rob Ronayne, removed him as the trustee and appointed the bank as a full trustee. That never changed. In the appointment documents of Charles Redlin, it talks about, yes, the bank was also appointed as an administrative trustee, and it says, to exercise such powers and authorities as the co-trustees may from time to time direct. It wouldn't have used the term co-trustees if there was just one trustee, Charles Redlin. The bank was also the trustee. Now, why would they do that? Well, because the default rule under 55(4)(3) and Article 11, Section O of the 2004 trust, the rule is that when you have co-trustees, there must be unanimity in everything that they do. The reason why they would want to appoint an administrative trustee is to write checks, do administrative trusts like signing tax returns, hiring CPAs, doing those types of routine things where they didn't need dual signatures on everything that was going on. I want to talk about the non-productive property component to Mr. Redlin's argument. It's absolutely ridiculous. The point of a non-productive provision in the trust to allow for a trustee to hold unproductive property is if the grantor gave a house to the trust or put in jewelry, artwork, heirlooms, those types of things. The purpose of the provision is to make sure the trustee doesn't have to sell or turn that or convert that asset into income-producing property, because that may not be what the grantor wanted. It may not be the purpose of the trust. The grantor doesn't want to be evicted from his house. He doesn't want to have their wedding ring pawned by the pawned off. They don't want their artwork auctioned off, and they don't want Mima's hutch sold at the Kingswood Rummage Sale. They want them held in the trust where they want to be safely protected and preserved under the terms of the document. To apply the authority to hold unproductive property to every asset that ever comes into the trustee's hand eviscerates the standard by which they have to invest assets prudently, even if it's a gross negligence standard. And yes, the trustee can open up a bank account. The power exists in the trust instrument. However, you have to judge the conduct of that trustee, and is it grossly negligent to hold $3 million that earns just slightly more than a checking account for 14 months? That's the conduct that needs to be evaluated, and we don't have the information to do that evaluation because we weren't allowed to depose Charles Redlin or the bank as to its investments decisions or lack of investment decisions. We simply ask that the court remand this case to the trial court with a determination that the bank and Mr. Redlin were co-trustees based on the plain language of the appointment documents. We ask the court to find the authority of the co-trustees to hold unproductive property and to open a bank account is not an end run around its fiduciary duty to invest. We ask the court to remand the case to the trial court for further discovery related to the co-trustee's conduct surrounding the deposit of $3 million into a money market account that only earned $840 for 18 months. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is now fully submitted. We'll be in recess for about 5 minutes.